On its oral submission docket, we don't have more because of settlement. There are matters in the order in which they'll be presented are as follows. Ricardo N. Inc. versus Maria Margarita Tercios de Argueta as administrator of the estate of Juan Luis Argueta, deceased, and as guardian of minor children from Cameron County. And ex parte Franklin D. Chambers, an original habeas corpus proceeding. In each of these matters, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. Petitioner or relator may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of our court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument, and of course we'll conclude these arguments before lunch. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. If you desire to listen to a tape of the arguments, you may make application with our clerk. Justice Doggett will not be here today, but he will participate in any deliberations of these cases that occur prior to December 31. Ms. Priscilla Owen, attorney from Houston, is in the audience. She will be assuming Justice Doggett's seat on January 1, and we welcome her to this session of the court. The court is now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Ricardo M. versus Tercios de Argueta.
Good morning. May it please the court. If I may introduce first Crystal Brown, who has prepared the written submissions on behalf of the appellants. Again, I'm Dan Pipitone. I will be presenting the oral argument today, both the preliminary argument as well as the rebuttal. I also was the trial attorney in the case. To a large extent, I'm very comfortable relying upon the written submissions with respect to the factual and procedural histories, as well as many of the arguments. What I'd like to do, although I shall certainly be guided by the court's questions, I would like to first address what many, I believe, consider to be the other issue in this case. It's my general perception that many people who have reviewed the briefs, as well as some other periodicals have been written about this, look as though this is a case that pertains to the jury issue. I think first and foremost, what I'd like to address is the Maritime Rescue Doctrine, its application by the trial court, as well as what the Court of Appeals did with it subsequently. Essentially, it is the petitioner's position that the Court of Appeals used the wrong branch of the Maritime Rescue Doctrine. And by using the wrong branch of the Maritime Rescue Doctrine, it had the effect of shifting the burden to the petitioner at trial. And that shifting of the burden then required the petitioner to disprove causation, in other words, to overcome the rebuttable presumption of causation. The Court of Appeals, the 13th Court of Appeals, went on to say in its opinion that any precise determination of causation is impossible. And when the Court of Appeals said that, they then used that statement, that conclusion, to determine that we, the petitioner, had not overcome that burden to disprove causation, because again, causation was just impossible to determine.
Counsel, I'm not clear about the facts. Perhaps it would help me at least if you would briefly review the facts from your perspective. Was there not an eyewitness, not the rig men see the deceased or the missing person jump from the ship?
Yes, that's correct.
An eyewitness?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The captain, David Aceto, saw the deceased jump overboard, actually remove his clothing, then jump overboard, as did the rigman, Sidney Malone. There was also a third man on board as well, the header of the boat, but there's no testimony available as to what he saw or didn't see.
Correct.
Thank you. To the best of a review of the record, there is really no knowledge whether the trial court actually addressed the Maritime Rescue Doctrine, or if so, how it went about addressing it. But I think if you look at what the Court of Appeals concluded, that there is no precise determination of causation that's possible. If the Court of Appeals had utilized the correct Rescue Doctrine branch, that branch being the one where the plaintiff, or the relator in this case, bears the burden of proving the causation element. If the Court of Appeals had correctly used that branch of the rescue doctrine, then it is very clear that the Court of Appeals statement to the effect that there's no precise determination of causation that's possible would have inured to the benefit of the petitioner here today. In other words, the fact that there is no way to determine the causation for the seaman's death would have inured to the benefit of the petitioner because the relator would have been unable to establish the causation element at the time of the trial. And that would have been the relator's burden at the time of trial had the court applied the correct branch of the rescue doctrine. As a result, we would respectfully urge this court to not only reverse the case back to the trial court, to reverse the judgment of the trial court as well as the Court of Appeals, but to render judgment in favor of the petitioner. A review of the record shows that while there may be some dispute as to whether there was negligence or whether there was an unseaworthy condition existing on the vessel, the fact of the matter is that the sole evidence that addressed the issue of causation comes from a marine surveyor that the plaintiff, or the relator here, enlisted, a Commander Edward C. Pangrass. During the time of trial, the only evidence that was elicited concerning causation that was permitted by the trial court pertained to Commander Pangrass, who unequivocally stated that even if the petitioner here today, the vessel owner, had exercised every possible measure to effect a search and a rescue without any failing whatsoever, or even if the vessel had every piece of equipment or apparatus on it to ensure the successful search and rescue, even if those things had been done perfectly by the vessel owner, notwithstanding that fact, he could not say that the search would have been accomplished or the rescue would have succeeded. In other words, he went on to say as well that it would have been pure and utter speculation to say that even if the vessel owner and its crew had performed the absolutely perfect search and rescue procedure, that still would not have resulted in the rescue of the deceased seaman. To a certain extent, I believe it's telling, if you were to review the relator's written submissions to this court, there is absolutely no reference in there, two pages that are on pages 18 and 19 of their written submissions, there's no reference whatsoever to the argument about the lack of causation in this case. Instead, they merely reiterate what the Court of Appeals said with respect to what is the negligence and what is the unseaworthy condition. But again, the relator does not address the fact that there is no evidence establishing a causal connection between the search and rescue efforts that were actually performed versus the eventual demise of the injured seaman. By way of review, if I may, the maritime rescue doctrine is a long-standing doctrine. Essentially, there are two branches to that doctrine. The first branch is considered the search and rescue aspect. In that, it contemplates that a seaman is not visible, not readily discernible from the vessel. His location is not one that the crew or the vessel owner is able to actually see. And as a result, it requires not only the rescue efforts, but first it requires, obviously, that a search be conducted. Now, there are two aspects of that first branch. If there is no search conducted by a vessel owner, then the maritime rescue doctrine shifts the burden of proof to the vessel owner. And it shifts the burden of proof to the vessel owner to disprove that even if it had searched, it would have shifted the burden to the vessel owner to prove that even if it had searched, that the search would not have resulted in the location of the overboard seaman. The rationale for that is very simple. If there is no effort exerted by the vessel owner to search, and there is no negative repercussions for its failing to search, then obviously very few vessel owners would be so motivated to search. It also recognizes that it would put an unfair burden upon the family of a deceased seaman to be actually required to prove that if the vessel had done a search, that it would have resulted in the finding or location of the overboard seaman, which then would have compelled the rescue effort.
Mr. Pepitone, you're making a legal argument, which to me is an argument in a vacuum. What are the facts from your perspective with regards to the rescue and apply the doctrine that you're talking about to the facts in this case as you perceive it?
Your Honor, I'm terribly sorry. Let me go back for a moment. What happened is there was a four-member crew on the Betty Ann, a vessel owned by Ricardo Ann. It went out to sea. It's a shrimp boat, commercial shrimp boat. While at sea, Argueta became despondent because he had learned of the infidelity of his wife. He told Captain Acero that he wished to return to shore. Captain Acero said, "We will finish the night shrimping, and then we will either call the Coast Guard or we shall take you to the nearest port, but we're 80 miles out at sea right now." In shrimping, you shrimp during the evening hours as opposed to the daylight hours. Apparently, and this is, again, somewhat conjecture, but according to the testimony of David Acero, the only witness permitted to testify at trial, Argueta became even more despondent. He refused to work. They put him in the cabin. And then at some point, while the crew was working on the back deck, Argueta left the cabin, took off his clothing, took off his shoes, and leapt overboard. It was there were 4 to 6 foot seas at the time. The winds were approximately 20 miles an hour. It was in the dead of night, approximately 1 o'clock a.m. As soon as he leapt overboard, the crew ran over and tried to locate him, and at no time did they ever see him after he actually leapt overboard.
A search was conducted.
Absolutely, sir. Both Commander Pangrass confirmed that in his testimony, as did David Acero. After he leapt overboard, they, of course, went to the rail to look for him, were unable to locate him. They immediately pulled in their rigs and turned around and conducted a search.
They had their nets out?
Yes, they did, sir.
It took some time to put them in, I would imagine.
It took about 15 minutes for them to retrieve their nets. And there may be
2 hours in calling the Coast Guard.
No, they immediately attempted to contact the Coast Guard, Your Honor. But their efforts to contact the Coast Guard were somewhat thwarted by the weather. Their CB radio and their sideband radio didn't allow them to reach the shore facility for the Coast Guard immediately. What they ended up doing is they contacted a vessel in between them and the shoreline. The Sybil Graham was the name of that fishing vessel, which then relayed the message. So while they immediately tried to contact the Coast Guard, they weren't successful in accomplishing contact for approximately an hour and 20 minutes, I believe it was.
So, it's Ricardo Lynn's view that under the rescue doctrine, it is a technical requirement that they must see the person physically in the water. It's not a matter of you watch the person fall overboard, but you technically, you must see them in the water. So you're saying their duties changed based on the fact that they ran to the place where he jumped overboard but didn't see him, and therefore a different duty applied.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, forgive me for not going through the facts. Perhaps I should have done that originally. But that is right. Under the first part of the rescue doctrine, which requires a search and a seizure, a search because he's not visible, the standard of care is different, as is the burden of proof. If one sees a seaman that's overboard, then the expectations for successfully accomplishing a rescue are increased, because if you obviously see somebody, it's very easy then to accomplish that rescue. On the other hand, if one cannot see the overboard seaman, then that involves first a search, and the expectations of accomplishing a successful search in a vast ocean at night are changed. And that's the rationale that the courts, primarily the Fifth Circuit courts, have utilized when making the distinction. The two branches of the rescue doctrine talk about the burden of proof. If one has to search and rescue, first search, then the burden of proof remains with the family of the deceased seaman. Because, again, the expectation of the success of the search dictates whether the search should have been successful. On the other hand, if one sees the seaman, then it's expected that they should be able to rescue that seaman. And that expectation of a successful rescue shifts the burden to the vessel owner to prove that even if they've done everything successfully to try the rescue, it would not have been successful. I hope I state that in a not too inarticulate fashion, but that is the reason for the distinction. If one is visible, then the burden shifts to the owner to prove why it couldn't successfully rescue that seal. If one is not visible, then there is no justification for serving, for shifting that burden. Instead, the vessel owner has its obligations are expanded because it has to do a search before it even has a chance to do that.
Go back just a moment to the jury issue? Initially, before it was removed to federal court, it was on the jury docket, but a jury fee had not been paid.
That's correct, Your Honor. Let me qualify that in one manner. The jury fee had not been paid as of October 16, 1987, which was the date of announcements, but had been paid on October 19th, the day of trial. In fact, I think it was paid immediately after the announcements on October 16th, 3 days before trial.
Now, is this the initial setting, or?
Yes, Your Honor. The October 19th setting was the initial trial setting prior to the removal of the state court case to federal court, as well as the initiation of a limitations of liability proceeding in federal court. There were actually two federal court proceedings that were later consolidated.
Who requested the jury?
The counsel for the relator, Richard Arroyo, had requested a jury four times in his various original petition and amended petitions thereafter. On that note, too, Your Honor, while the fee was paid eventually by the petitioner's counsel, predecessor counsel, and the demand was made by the relator's counsel, there's a recent case out of the Court of Appeals, the 13th Court of Appeals, to the effect that the fact that one party does one of the elements and the other party does the second of the two elements is still accomplishing the same task. That's Almaguer. It was decided August 11, 1994 this year.
Same Court of Appeals that decided this case.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
Your Honor, my name is Miguel Saldana, and I am a trial lawyer in Brownsville, Texas. First of all, I'd like to say that I'm honored by the privilege, and I'm very proud, and my family is very proud to practice before you for the first time in my career. Your Honor, I would like to kind of address, he emphasized, the relator did, the rescue doctrine. But I would like to basically take it in the steps that have been outlined by the court in terms of addressing the issue of the jury trial and then the rescue doctrine. Your Honor, my opinion is that the trial by jury is an invalid right, and I also am in agreement that it should be jealously guarded by the courts of the state at all times. My own personal opinion is that even in civil matters, that even at the last minute, anyone requesting a jury trial should have or should be afforded one. I feel that strongly about that situation. In light of that, we balance that with the policy requirements that the courts and the trial court judges have and be afforded the opportunity to manage their dockets in a way that will be administratively and judicially efficient. So we have to balance these two things. In doing so, unfortunately, there are procedural pitfalls and miscues by counsel that often lead to, on procedure and procedure itself, a waiver of this most precious right. I believe that it is unequivocal that in this situation, the petitioners procedurally waived their right to a jury trial. What Mr. Pipitone fails to tell the court is that although the fee was paid It was paid, it was not timely paid. The case that he refers to from the 13th refers to someone demanding a jury trial timely and a jury fee being paid by the other side timely. This was not the case in this situation.
By the time the court ultimately reached the case following remand and removal and remand from federal court, the jury fee had been paid within the requisite time period, had it not?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
And so how, on what basis would you contend a jury trial was not available under those circumstances?
Your Honor, we go to the second point that the court wished to hear arguments on, and that is this was an inherent power of the court to impose sanctions as a result of what the trial court viewed as being a procedural, dilatory tactic by the defendants when they realized their error of having waived their jury trials under the Texas rules to remove this court.
You don't rely on any rule of civil procedure, any rule of civil procedure, but on this inherent power to sanction by striking the...
That's correct, Your Honor, because there is a sufficient amount of cases and that are before the court, I believe the Dawson case and other cases that say if there is some type of continuance or putting off of the trial date, then that request becomes timely. And my argument is on the second one, Your Honor, that the court said, I believe this removal was strictly a sham removal. It was for purposes of delay. It was for purposes of attempting to do this. When I get this case back, it will be tried as it stood on the date of removal.
Mr. Saldana, in regard to the removal in bad faith and the sham as you characterized it, the Court of Appeals characterized it, did not the federal court judge who heard the case, we had a motion for sanctions before him, who was in a very good position to determine whether or not sanctions would be granted on motion based on a sham removal or bad faith, did not the federal judge, who was in a very good position to determine whether the bona fides of the parties, ruled against you in that issue?
Your Honor, yes, he did, and I would like to turn the court's attention to the transcript in that his ruling was almost one in passing, Your Honor. He ruled that the substantive law was clear, that predecessor counsel, in fact, that had a predecessor case that was on all fours with this particular case. He indicated almost in passing at the end of his spoken order, as he spoke down, that he would not impose sanctions because there was some questions of federal matters. But nonetheless, when it got back, I believe that it is not dispositive to whether it was a removal for purposes of delay that the federal judge did not impose sanctions. I do not, in my opinion, believe that that's dispositive. I think we have to look at the facts. The eve of trial, announcement date, 17 months had elapsed since the filing of the original petition and no request for jury nor jury fee had been paid.
If the trial court has the inherent power to strike a jury and pay jury fee, does the trial court have the inherent power, under your theory, to strike the pleadings and render judgment against the party based on dilatory trial tactics?
Your Honor, I believe that the trial court has a wide range of discretion, and only an abuse of discretion standard should be considered.
Does it extend as far as
It extends as far as striking pleadings, entering directed verdicts, and I unfortunately know the result of those sanctions all too well. Therefore, I believe that the sanction that was imposed was not a death penalty sanction, and in fact was a sanction that in essence cut both ways, because the plaintiff who carries the burden to the trial court was not afforded an opportunity to continue to develop his case as well, which delays tend to favor the plaintiffs in being able to put their ducks in order, so to speak, and have a proper presentation of the case on the merits. So that is our position on that matter, Your Honor. I believe that the 13th ruling that that the trial, that on the second time around, concerning Your Honor's question, that it had been on file by that time 3 years and 7 months, that the denial of the jury trial was incidental to the sanction that the trial court imposed.
Ms. Savinia, if I understand your argument about the finding of no bad faith in the removal by the federal judge, you're saying that judge said, well, there was an arguable basis for the removal, therefore I'm not going to find that it was done in bad faith. And you're saying we're not really interested in that. Regardless of whether they had an arguable basis for removal, they really did it because they wanted to delay the case. Is it your, I mean, yeah, do I understand that's really what you're saying about the removal issue? Is that it was really done to delay it, and the federal judge really never addressed that. He simply addressed whether or not there was an arguable basis for the removal.
That's correct, Your Honor. He never really addressed that issue. He said in passing, there is a federal issue here, although counsel is misplaced, is the direct words that he used, although misplaced, and therefore I'm not going to impose sanctions. And that was the federal court's, Judge Hinojosa's ruling on that.
Well, then would it be your position that a trial judge would have the inherent power to sanction a lawyer for bringing a dilatory motion if it was not more than simply arguable? In other words, if you bring a position that is not more than simply arguable, then I have the inherent power to determine it's brought just for delay purposes and to sanction you for that?
Yes, Your Honor, especially if one considers the entire life of the situation. They had, as you know, Section 185 and Section 183 of 42 U.S.C., which provides for limitations of liabilities, but also provides six-month liability, I mean, limitations. This case was on file for 17 months. They did have a right, and arguably they did have something to go before the federal court, but they don't have a right to sit on that until announcement day, Your Honor. And I think that the trial court considered the totality of those circumstances and that it was a pure procedural move on the eve of trial. And I think that's very important.
This is a fascinating issue, but as petitioners point out, if they're correct on the first point, we need not even get to it. So could you turn your attention to the Maritime Rescue Doctrine and whether or not Court of Appeals applied the wrong branch, and talk a little bit about the causation. Who had the burden of proof, and was the causation issues met?
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate us moving to that section because I feel that that would be a remand situation on the first issue. Should the court rule against my case, then I think the relief granted would be a remand to the trial court. Now, the rescue doctrine. First of all, I think that the Reyes case that was decided out of the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, I think, is controlling and provides a lot of guidance to what was brought before you by Mr. Pipitone concerning the rescue doctrine. However, I am in disagreement fundamentally in it being brought before this court in this respect. Reyes clearly states that the search and rescue doctrine requires ship's officers to both rescue the seamen and an emphasis is added by the court on the conjunction and to effect a search of area so long as it is reasonably possible that the seamen can survive. It is a conjunctive aspect that although it has two parts, I believe that language is clear when it says it must attempt a rescue, it must search if the rescue is unsuccessful. For petitioners to say that there are two branches and that they are independent, in my opinion, they are trying to, and that the 13th utilized the wrong test, in my opinion, is an attempt to evoke the jurisdiction of this court in this case.
You believe there's no difference based on whether or not the overboard seaman is sighted in the water or not?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that there is, but I believe that if there is there's a continuum to the search and rescue doctrine. There's a beginning, there's an end to it, and that, those are the two components, but they are not completely opposite, Your Honor. Or independent, or can be applied independently. And I think the language of Reyes clearly states that. And in doing so, I believe that they are invoking the jurisdiction of this court in what is basically a sufficiency argument. And Mr. Pipitone's own words before this court a few minutes ago was that there was no evidence of causation. And we all know those are arguments to be had at the 13th and at the appellate level, and are not proper to be brought before the Supreme Court. That is our basic position, and we wish not to waive that. In addition, Your Honor...
What evidence is there of causation?
Your Honor, there is evidence, Your Honor, that the vessel was unseaworthy. The finder of fact found that the crew was not seaworthy in its training on man overboard procedures.
What difference does it make if it was based on Captain Pendergrass's testimony that even if the vessel was perfect and the crew's actions were perfect, it would be mere speculation as to whether or not the rescue would have been effectuated?
Your Honor, again, we're reviewing the evidence, and in that respect, all I can say is that the case law in federal court, Reyes, for example, Henry, Queen Marine Sulphur, those cases indicate that there is a presumption of causation, that a seaman is a ward of the owner, that he gives up his liberty, and everything that the court does in interpreting these things will be done so liberally to presume causation. In this case, if there is a finding that there was that the vessel was not seaworthy, there is a presumption of causation. If there is a finding that there was negligence, there is a presumption of causation. In this case, there was such findings by the court, by the fact finder. My concern in this case is what would be the proper disposition of this matter should the court rule in the petitioner's favor.
Well, before you get to that, the Court of Appeals seemed to think it mattered whether you could see the seaman or not. If you couldn't, then causation is not presumed, and you would have to prove it. And if you could, it would be the other way. Do you disagree with that?
No, sir, I do not. I would just like to elaborate on that, is that there's a presumption of causation when the man goes overboard and they don't have, for example, the proper life-saving equipment, lines, rocket lines.
Even if you can't see?
That's a fact question, Your Honor. That's the point I'm trying to make.
Well, I'm trying to get the legal question.
Okay. The legal question is, yes, sir, there are two points to that doctrine. If you can't see him, then it's not that that there's no presumption. Then the second part applies. Did they conduct a reasonable search? Did they stay in the Gulf waters, which are warm waters, sufficiently long enough? If they did not conduct that search reasonably, then causation also will be implied.
If it is not implied or presumed.
Or presumed.
Did you prove it?
Your Honor, I believe that there are some fact findings that are omitted, that would necessarily have to be rehashed in order to apply the proper legal principles, and that's my concern. If it's granted on the petitioner's error on the rescue doctrine, then in reading Reyes, and what Reyes had to do, and what the Fifth Circuit had to do, was they had to remand not to the 13th for the application of the evidence to the proper standard, but to the trial court to get underlying facts as to did they see him in the water, did they not see him in the water.
What is the evidence on that at this point?
Your Honor, the evidence, I disagree with counsel somewhat, is that one of the seamen, not the captain, Mr. Sidney Malone, saw him take off his clothes. They saw him go to it was a very rough day, 9-foot seas by the captain and by the petitioner's own admission, with 20-mile-an-hour winds. Those are extremely rough conditions. As to why he did it, and got to that point, there's a lot of conjecture that's involved. The petitioners in this case have tried to inflect that he was despondent and this was suicidal. A close reading shows that there's no evidence to support those things.
What about could they see?
Your Honor, the evidence is that Malone did not actually even see him leave. That he looks at him and that he's standing on the top of the, I'm poor in nautical terms, but the top of the side railing, and that he turns around and he's gone, he goes, and that's it. That's the only evidence that's before there. There's no evidence that he goes and looks. The only evidence is that at this point he goes and tells the captain, who stops the boat, brings in the rigging, and does not, in essence, effectuate a search until 20 minutes later. Again, going
after the disappearance overboard, or 20 minutes after he stopped the boat and started pulling his nets in, or what?
20 minutes after he was overboard, Your Honor. So it took him 20 minutes to bring in his straws, the netting.
But is that negligence, or is that necessary?
Your Honor, I don't know.
Sure, I would have with full nets conduct a circular search on high seas, pulling its nets? Or
I think that would be reasonable, Your Honor.
Should he his nets loose, or was it reasonable to stop and pull the net?
Sure, I believe that it would have been in order to be able to cover more ground. In addition, though, Your Honor, they did not place a marker buoy. The court found that they were negligent in man overboard procedures, that the first thing they should have done was place a marker buoy and notify the Coast Guard. The fact finder found that they were not trained in sideband radio procedures. They were 80 miles offshore. Sidebands give you 200 to 300 mile range. They did not know how to operate those radios. They had to use their CBs to contact another ship whose sideband operator was able to contact the Coast Guard, eventually getting them out there some hours later. So
why was the Court of Appeals justified in applying the branch of the rescue doctrine that is used when you can see the seaman if you say the evidence is nobody ever saw him after he jumped over?
Your Honor, because I believe that under Reyes that it is not a separate branch, that it starts with number one, they have to do everything possible to rescue that seaman. Even if they don't see him, but he has just plunged in the water, they have a duty to throw a line, to throw a life preserver, to mark the spot with a marker buoy. They have those duties. Once they have determined that they cannot see him and a reasonable immediate search indicates that, then the second aspect kicks in, which is that aspect that they have to conduct a reasonable search for that period of time in which a seaman could reasonably exist in the conditions of the sea. And that is my argument, Your Honor, that the Reyes Court makes the rescue doctrine conjunctive and not separate. And so there is no, that when you apply, you apply in totality to the facts and the circumstances at that time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
What if you didn't have adequate equipment on that boat? I mean, there's some evidence of that. Does that either change the burden of proof or excuse the causation or provide a presumption of causation?
Your Honor, the element of causation is separate and apart from a finding of negligence or unseaworthiness. While we dispute the contention that we were negligent and that the vessel was unseaworthy, for purposes of the argument today, it's a position of the petitioner that it is totally irrelevant, because even if we were negligent, even if the vessel was unseaworthy and lacked equipment, notwithstanding that fact, it remains a burden upon the relator to prove and establish causation. And in that regard, the relator has not done that at the trial level.
What about his argument about the presumption of causation under the Reyes case?
The Reyes case is a case that deals with a seaman who is visible. And because a seaman is visible, the expectations for a successful search are increased, and then it would be up to the vessel owner.
Does the Reyes case specifically set out that in cases where the victim is visible,
yes,
there's a presumption of causation, or does it, is the language broader than that?
It's, to a certain extent, it requires some interpretation. But in the Reyes case, it was very clear that the seaman was visible. In fact, he voluntarily jumped overboard to go for a swim in the ocean, lost control. It was during daylight hours. He lost control, became exhausted, and then passed away. If the court reads, though, Reyes, which, again, is a case involving a seaman who is very visible, if the court reads Schlichter, one of the cases cited in our brief, it's Schlichter versus Port Arthur Towing Company. That is a case where the seaman fell overboard and was not visible. It was at nighttime, and the seaman was not visible at all in that case. And in that case, the court, again, it's a Fifth Circuit case, again decided by Judge Brown, who writes a fair number of the Fifth Circuit maritime-type cases, opinions. Judge Brown applied the standard that since he was not visible, therefore, the burden of proof as to causation remained with the plaintiff. In this case,
is this causation as to the inability to rescue or the failure to rescue, causation as to what?
Causation as to whether any efforts would have proved successful in accomplishing a rescue.
And you say that any negligence, any unseaworthiness, any lack of equipment, any lack of training, or any failure on the part of the officer and crew of this boat are irrelevant as far as causation is concerned? How does one go about proving it?
I suppose it wouldn't be appropriate to say they're totally irrelevant. That has a negative connotation.
First thing anyone does is drop a marker buoy. The total line, you drop a marker. So you can mark your spot. It's a big sea up.
Your Honor, yeah, in that case, that is correct. You can mark your spot with a marker buoy, especially if it's during the daytime hours, with respect to this particular case. If it's during daytime hours, you can do that. But it is a fact that surface currents and underwater currents are markedly different. And while you could put a marker buoy down, this is something that was brought out in Pangrass' testimony during the course of trial, that a marker buoy could have the purpose of misdirecting the search just as easily as allowing the search. Instead, what Captain Aceto did...
What's standard procedure?
It may be standard procedure during the daytime, Your Honor. What Captain Aceto did, though, is he also marked immediately on his map and used his LORAN to determine the position so that what he could immediately return to. And in our contention, especially because it was a lost overboard at nighttime, that was a more appropriate thing, and that way he was more certain of being able to return to the same area.
But still, are these legal issues or factual issues under the circumstances?
Those would be fact issues under the circumstances, but there are two things that a plaintiff must prove in these types of cases. One is that the vessel was negligent, or the crew was negligent, and the vessel was unseaworthy. The second thing they must prove is that negligence or unseaworthy condition was the proximate cause for the peril. And in this case, Commander Pangrass says that even if they put out a marker buoy, even if they thrown a lifeboat, any number of things, notwithstanding that, it would be pure and utter speculation. That was his testimony.
But we are not here, and we're not, this court is not permitted to determine sufficiency questions. It's a question of any evidence. And you're arguing that all the elements of negligence, unseaworthiness, lack of training, lack of equipment, and all that that the other side has offered is no evidence of proximate cause.
Yes, that is what I'm arguing.
You have to be arguing that for this court.
Yeah, because I'm not, although counsel did say that we were arguing sufficiency of evidence, that is a mischaracterization. We are arguing that there was no evidence. Again, two elements. You have to prove negligence and unseaworthiness, and then causation. In this case, the only evidence about causation is sourced from Commander Pangrass. And in this case, Commander Pangrass said it would be pure and utter speculation to establish that causation. With that testimony being...
There's no contrary evidence by anyone.
That's correct.
Had they done these, they might have been able to find.
That, yes, Commander Pangress is the sole evidence, and that evidence is equivocal at best. And in my opinion, and hopefully in the court's as well, it constitutes no evidence as to causation because he is, again, engaging in pure and utter speculation. With respect to the... Oh, I'm sorry.
Your time has expired unless there's another question. Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. The court will now take a brief recess.